Hello and welcome to the Student Loan Planner podcast. Today's show, I am going to make fewer jokes and be a little bit more serious because today's topic is a little bit more serious. And I'm thankful that I don't have to do this alone either. So I'm really glad that our consultant, Megan Landris, is joining us on today's show. How's it going, Megan?
Hey, doing well today. How are you doing, Travis?
Good. Well, even when you talk about the darkest of subjects, I still think it's important to at least attempt to find some humor or some positivity in it. I want to respect people who have had really difficult mental health challenges in the past year while also just talking plainly about these statistics. So we're going to try to strike a good balance there. But I think this is really interesting stuff to talk about because everybody knows that student loan debt has a big mental health burden. So Megan, you've helped hundreds and hundreds of clients now for SLP, and a lot of people deal with what I would call like more common kind of feelings like anxiety, depression, hopelessness. What is a typical mental health burden that someone brings to you look like?
Yeah, I can give an example from one of my consults last night. So I was talking with a woman and her husband was on the call with us. She's the only one with student loan debt in the relationship. So that's one strain that I feel like I see a lot is when one spouse is straddled with it, inevitably the other spouse has to deal with it in some form or fashion, you know, because if we're on an income-driven plan, tax filing status matters, it impacts the budget, other financing decisions. So that was one, I don't want to say it was awkward, but it started off where the spouse with no student loan debt wanted a plan and wanted very specific steps to implement that plan. And of course, that's what we want to go through on our consults. But some of the other negative, maybe emotions that were coming to the table from the person who had the student loans was just, I think, guilt, a little bit of shame of not only the balance, how much they owed, but also not knowing exactly how to tackle it. And by default, they had done the right thing. They were a clear passive approach case where they should have been paying on income, reducing their payment as much as possible. They had been filing taxes separately to do that. So by, in a way, accident, they were doing the right thing, but you know, they were coming to the table feeling so bad, feeling like they hadn't been doing the right thing. And I think a lot of negative emotions around debt stem from just what we've been taught about debt. Growing up, our grandparents, our parents, our uncles, what they've told us. And student loans don't really fall into the traditional debt category. So I feel like there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of stress, some tension sometimes around student loans that I typically see in my consults.
Yeah. Well, let's call out some of those. So negative thoughts lead to negative emotions. I'm stealing that from my own counselor because this pandemic year for me has been crazy high anxiety. I don't know about you listening to this, but I've had crazy high levels of like anxiety, at times depressive feelings, like feeling like when the heck is this national nightmare going to end? Global nightmare, right? Like when is it all just going to be over? And so I reached out to one of these, like, you see all these like mental health ads on like Facebook and stuff and Instagram. And so I just like, okay, I'm just going to give it a try just to see if this helps me manage some of my like negative thoughts and emotions better. And it really has. Like I identified some weird coping mechanisms. Like I was playing too many video games, Megan. Still I am, unfortunately, but I'm managing a little better. My counselor helped me identify that was like a coping mechanism for my negative feelings. And so other people are struggling with negative thoughts due to student loan debt. Like you mentioned, guilt, shame, those negative thoughts lead to these really bad feelings where you feel bad. And so part of not feeling bad about your student loans is how to deal with these negative thoughts. So Megan, let's say not student debt, let's just say general debt. What does society say about you if you've borrowed like way more than you can pay back?
That you're irresponsible, bad with money, maybe, you know, just not good things.
Dumb.
Yeah, not good things.
Yeah, dumb, you deserve it. I'm going to dump on white guys for a second, but what's that old angry white guy on the internet going to say about you, right? Like, like that's all these feelings and stuff. And the thing is, if you have all this debt, if you buy into that societal thought about debt, then even if you don't completely agree, like you still run up against those feelings. Mm-hmm. And so you're like, you apply that debt thinking to your student debt and you start to think, wow, am I dumb? Am I irresponsible? Am I somebody that deserves this? And so one thing we talk about is debt is not really a debt. it's an income tax. Can you just high level explain to our listeners what that means?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with federal loans, if someone's balance is greater than their income, our ratio we're using right now is 1.25 times their income, then going a very passive approach with your student loans mathematically makes more sense. There's, you know, a lot of other pros to going that path. But when we look at it like that, we're not looking at it as a debt anymore. We're looking at it truly as kind of a tax on your income, because that's exactly what it is with the income-driven payment. It's only 10 or 15% of your discretionary income. So that's what we mean by thinking of it as a tax. I think you also like to joke. I'm thinking about this because I recently did a presentation using your slides where you said, think of yourself as a German citizen because Germans pay more in taxes than we do. And that always gets a little bit of a chuckle whenever I tell folks that is instead of a debt where we want to pay it off aggressively and we're thinking about how to pay it off aggressively, it's more so, how do we pay as little as possible to maximize the forgiveness?
Right. So I don't know what German dentists make, but I'm going to assume that it's less money than American dentists, right? Just in an absolute sense, the Polish dentist will do your root canal for like $20 and a beer. Okay. I really apologize. I seriously apologize if someone is Polish American here. I am not at all insulting Polish Americans. We love Polish Americans. I am attempting to make a joke that Eastern European dentists have a reputation for doing quality work for like way, way cheaper than American dentists. That's what I mean by that. Okay. So, yeah, I'm hopefully people will forgive me for that. So it's like what happens when you charge way less for those procedures, somebody that's like the Polish dentist is going to make way less than the American dentist. And like in countries with socialized medicine, like in general, healthcare practitioners make less. So yeah, your dental school might cost way less in Germany, but you're going to make a lot less money and you're going to have a lot higher taxes. And you might say, well, you have a better social safety net. And that's true. But that's what we mean is like when you have your student loan debt, worst case scenario is 10% of your income. And we're already getting signals that it's a tax-free forgiveness, most likely long-term. So then it's just 10% of your income. And if you take a typical American tax rate and add 10% to that, it's similar to what you get taxed at in Europe. Actually, it's still a little less. And you make significantly more money net of that tax than do the healthcare practitioners in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Gosh, Megan, I'm really trying to step on a minefield here, aren't I? Is there a better way you would have said that? Hopefully people forgive me. I just, real quick, totally random comment about Poland, right? One time I visited when I was single, like when I was doing my early retirement thing, and I will never forget this. It was $4 for a bus ride from Warsaw to Krakow, which is like 4 hours drive for like $4. And they had attendants on the bus serving like hot tea and coffee with flat screen TVs with leather seats with all the latest movies like in the, and I was just like, oh my gosh, let me live in Poland.
That sounds really nice.
Yeah. So I'm already breaking my promise about being more serious here in this podcast, but I think it's helpful to deal with this stuff. The big stat from this week's show that's going to really be shocking to people is we did a survey in 2019 and we asked, have you ever considered suicide due to student loan debt? And we're going to talk about some mental health resources if you have ever or are currently feeling this way. 1-800-273-TALK. It's the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. Please give them a call if you ever have or know somebody who's having these feelings. So with that thing that we wanted to kind of preface this with, so we had 1 in 15 people that said they had suicidal ideation due to student loans in 2019. We were originally planning to do this survey in March of 2020, and then a global pandemic happened. And so we didn't do it, and so we just finished the latest iteration in March of 2021. And we asked the same set of questions. This time, 1 in 14 people had considered suicide due to student loan debt, and that we found that debt-to-income ratio was the primary cause of people's mental health challenges due to student loans. So, Megan, maybe you can talk about just in general the number of borrowers that owe six figures. Let's just share that with our listeners just to give them kind of a context of what's going on in a broad sense.
Yeah. So in 2017, there were about 2.4 million borrowers with over 100,000 in federal student loan debt. looking at this number now, Q4 of 2020, which is actually September because that's the fiscal year, right? There were 3.2 million borrowers with over six figures of federal student loan debt. So this is a growing problem. And if debt to income ratio has a really big impact on mental health with student loan debt in general, this is something we need to talk about more. It needs to be something that's talked about more because it's not a problem that seems to be getting better.
Yeah, crazy that the number of people have grown that much. Just to think that the number of people that would find our content potentially helpful, like because we focus on six-figure borrowers, grew 50% almost in just 3 years. It's crazy. So it makes sense why that number of people that have said that they have considered suicide due to student loan debt, that makes sense why that number would have increased. Because debt-to-income ratios got worse because the amount of people who owe six figures in debt grew so fast. Mm-hmm. So that's scary because so we would see like the amount of people saying that they have ideation due to student loans, I think will continue to get worse until it hits like a stability level. Because mm-hmm. that's kind of one thing that we found. I think we found like one in 11 people that had a greater than 2-to-1 debt-to-income ratio had suicidal ideation due to student loans. So right around, you could say like 10% of people, I think, is that stability level as that debt continues to increase that will eventually hit. So Megan, maybe you can share some of the other findings from this survey that we did.
Yeah, so a couple other statistics. So respondents who owed more than 2 times their income were 2.5 times more likely to experience the suicidal ideation compared to borrowers who owed less than their earnings. This one was really interesting to me. 1 in 8 single women who owe more than twice their income had suicidal ideation due to student loans. Now, I have some thoughts on that. But for single women earning less than $50,000, that same number rose 1 to 6. Or
1 in 6, yeah.
Yeah. And what's also really interesting, because this is something that I probably would have assumed, but enrollment in generous forgiveness programs such as PSLF did not seem to reduce the risk of that suicidal ideation due to the debt. So in my thought process, I would have thought, oh, wow, PSLF could actually make this better, but it showed that it does not. It makes people feel actually trapped or more constricted because they feel like they have to rely on that to have a successful student loan repayment plan. That was very interesting to me. Another statistic, 1 in 8 unemployed borrowers and those earning $50,000 or less experienced suicidal ideation due to their student loans. And then one other key number we were looking at was six-figure earners with student loan balances greater than 2 times their earnings experienced a spike, actually, in suicidal ideation from 4% to 8%.
Sure.
Lots of numbers there.
It's a lot of numbers. Let's break down each one of them mm-hmm. just to try to talk through the why and just come up with some theories.
Mm-hmm.
In the face of things, it makes sense that people who owe a lot of student loans relative to their income would have more negative emotion around student debt than somebody who owes less than their income. So that kind of makes sense. I think what kind of surprised me was like anxiety levels were like somewhat similar. Like people kind of reported having anxiety about student debt, regardless of how much they had. Whereas the suicidal ideation was only super different when you had these like huge debt to income ratios.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of interesting. You had some solid, I guess, like we also noticed this gender gap. And like mm-hmm. in particular, we noticed it for single women earning low incomes or just single women who had like really high debt. And initially I thought like maybe this is just like a story of the burden of student debt on women. But then I also thought, well, there's also like women have a higher debt and earn less than men. So that could also be explained by debt-to-income ratio. What are your thoughts about some of the findings around the unique impact of student loan debt stress on women?
Yeah, and we've known, I think, the statistic for a while, but women are consistently pursuing higher education at a rate higher than men at this time. So there are more women enrolled in these higher ed programs taking on potentially more debt because graduate school is more expensive. But I think you've got it right on the nose with pay gaps that still exist today. That makes it harder for a woman who has a similar job with similar qualities or the same background of education to a man who's making more income than them. The man has more income to pay that student loan debt down with than the woman who probably has more student loan debt to pay it down with. Another thing I thought was really interesting was that suicidal ideation with single women was 62% higher than what it was for single men. And so I think the mental burden of student debt is higher for women. And I think there's a lot of different, you know, the pay gap, the potentially higher student loan debt balances. There's a lot of things that contribute to this, but it does weigh heavily on women from what it looks like.
So I read this interesting Washington Post story that talked about like some of the student loan burdens on people. And I really wished we had asked about racial background or ethnic background in this survey so that we could have looked at that dimension as well. Because this story in the Washington Post was so fascinating because it was like, wow, I have such a giant blind spot when it comes to what it's like to be someone other than Travis, who, you know, obviously I'm a white guy, right? Mm-hmm. And so they highlighted like a African-American woman who was basically saying, if I go into a room with a bunch of decision makers and I'm the only black woman in the room, I feel like I have to be overqualified just for people to take me seriously. And she talked about getting a PhD from Penn, Ivy League school. I have that luck of going into a room and just being able to say, hi, I'm Travis, and I don't think about that. Like, it's not something that I even have to think about. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, like that makes so much sense that she feels compelled to pursue this PhD. And she said in the story that like she didn't really think that it was necessary for her job. She didn't really need it for her job, but she pursued it anyway because she felt like she needed that, her boss said, to be taken seriously in her role. And I thought, wow, that's like terrible. Mm-hmm. I mean, first of all, like talking about racism, like that's a great example of it. And then just so that she felt like she needed to be able to introduce herself saying, I'm Dr. So-and-so versus I'm Miss So-and-so or I'm whatever. Mm-hmm. So I think that was really interesting too. So I guess my guess is that if we looked at groups where women of color who might have even more debt on average and even lower incomes, we know that black women earn, I forget the percent on the dollar compared to white men. I think it's like 81 cents on the dollar is the women versus men quote. And I forget what the black women versus white men number is, but it's less. That means their debt to income ratios would be even more. And so then they would be probably at risk of even greater mental health burdens due to student loan debt. So that, I don't know, like that was something else that I just had never really thought about before reading that story. Like, oh, duh, women might feel the need to get more credentials than men, all things equal, to be treated the same way. What are your thoughts as to why like women pursue, you know, higher ed credentials at a greater rate than men?
Yeah, I think it is not validation. That's not the right word, but it is the desire to be credible, to be respected in the room. When you do walk into the room, have the doctor title. I think that's a piece of it. I think women could also have a natural like curiosity or enjoyment of education.
So you're just saying us men, we like to get our hands soaked in black oil grease, like while we're doing the renovation of the countertop or something for our blue collar jobs. No, I mean, there is some truth to that. Like if you look at what do women and men sort into for who knows the reason, but you see it in the data, right? Like women sort into more healthcare jobs, more higher education jobs. Men sort into these more like construction. And this is like disproportionate, right? We know that there's obviously plenty of men and women in both of these fields, but this is just something that kind of happens. Mm. So we're going to have like a whole episode on this. I want to preview this for our podcast listeners. So we actually have Lauren, Megan, and Molly, the three female student loan consultants on the Student Loan Planner team, are going to have like a deep dive podcast into the effects of student loan debt on women that I'm really excited to listen to. And so that's going to be coming out in a few weeks. So let's go to this next point. Mm-hmm. PSLF and forgiveness programs had no difference. So 1 in 15 people who were pursuing PSLF said they had suicidal ideation due to student loans. 1 in 15 who were not pursuing PSLF said they had suicidal ideation due to student loans. And 1 in 11 people that had no idea what they were doing said that they had ideation. Mm-hmm. So the people who don't know what plan they're doing with their student loans. So that's kind of a case in point of why a plan's important. Mm-hmm. But interesting that we saw no difference between something like PSLF that does get tax-free forgiveness and something like not PSLF, which doesn't. So why were you shocked or not shocked about this? And what were your thoughts about how forgiveness like had such a little impact on mental health struggles due to student loans?
Mm-hmm. So in my planning brain, I was thinking, you know, oh, PSLF is a really great program. You know, if you pursue it, you check the boxes to successfully achieve the forgiveness, that's a great option. But I think I failed to think about the fact that I'm a CSLP. I know student loans forwards and backwards and these repayment options. Most folks don't. And having the education about how to qualify for PSLF, that's big. And if people don't have that, then that makes them feel more nervous about the program. So that's one. A second thought I had was, I think the faith in PSLF in general is just really low. I don't think I've had very, very few calls where I have not gotten the question, do you think PSLF is going to be around for me? Or is this something that actually works? You know, I get that almost every call where PSLF is relevant, where it is someone who's actually, they're truly enjoying their job. They expect to stay in public service in that capacity, or at least just in the public service world in general. And even them, they have just a lack of faith in PSLF overall. And I think that's big in part to media. I think the media blows up certain things that scares people. You know, there's that same article that I think I combat on all those calls is the 99% rejection rate. I think people who don't even have student loans know about that article and could recite it. So I think that's another thing that I wasn't really thinking about, is just the lack of faith in the program itself, which could make people, you know, nervous about it and scared to pursue it, because that would be, it would be horrible to pursue that, think you're on track, pay as little as possible to get there. And then if it blew up in your face, then we spent so long not paying that balance. Again, PSLF is a good program. It works for folks who are, that are qualified. So that's not to scare you away from it, but that's a thought I had too. And then the last thought was that it does, or it can make people feel trapped or committed to a certain job or a certain industry, and it's constricting. It limits potentially their options if they did want to take a private sector job. So I talk about that a lot on our consults, on if there was a private opportunity that came to pass that they wanted to jump on, is it worth it? And I think that also makes people feel guilty or feels like they have to commit to the PSLF route if they're in that space already, which that's not always the case either. I know you do a great job, Travis, of talking through like how PSLF is not the end all be all. And we have a little net worth calculator that you built into our worksheet that you can download for free online or on our website that helps map out that PSLF is a great option, but it doesn't have to be the end all be all. And there's a plan that we can find that works if you did want to forego PSLF. But I think in general, that's a scary thought for folks. So those were some of the, or the three like top things that came to mind after I was like, oh, okay, I was wrong there.
Well, yeah, like for the uninitiated, PSLF usually makes 1 year's difference as to when you can retire, mm-hmm. like compared to pursuing like a forgiveness without PSLF. Mm-hmm. And if you look at just increasing your savings rate, like that can knock off a decade off of your retirement date. So that's one of the things that we do a lot in the consult, is like compare forgiveness programs based to other financial decisions you can make better for you that make a much bigger difference. So you don't have to let the student debt rule your life. When you were saying like some of those thoughts that you had, I couldn't stop thinking, you know, if you asked me if like, if say I feel trapped due to my debt, right? If you said, do you want to go to prison for 10 years or 20 years? Which one's better? I'm going to go with option C. I don't want to go to prison.
Right.
That's kind of like also what I'm thinking about is sort of like, yeah, like debt makes people feel trapped. Like debt makes you feel shame, guilt, all these negative emotions. I can't start a family. I can't buy a house. Oh, look at this awesome HGTV show. Guess what? I can't do any of that. Oh, look at this beautiful picture of this cute baby on Instagram of this girlfriend that I knew in my college sorority. And guess what? I can't have that because of my debt, right? There's all these like feelings. And I think that PSLF is not the fix for those feelings. Like you said, You were talking about how all the headlines and all of the people always ask you, like, is it going to happen? That's so interesting. So a lot of it could just be people don't really trust the PSLF program because they haven't seen with their own eyes, like, massive amounts of forgiveness actually happen yet to, like, somebody that they really know. Like, that'll be really interesting. Like, once a lot of people start seeing
the
people they went to medical school with, or, like, friends they work at the hospital with, or, like, lawyers that they did some public interest clubs with in law school. Like, once people see their friends start getting PSLF, maybe that trust factor will go up.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess maybe right now, like, that trust factor is pretty low. Yeah. So maybe that's an issue.
Yeah. Another comment I hear a lot, actually, from folks who are pursuing PSLF that are questioning it is they say, well, I wanted to schedule this call because my colleagues, they went ahead and refinanced. They didn't want to trust PSLF. They didn't want to deal with it. And so I just wanted to double check before I did it. So for me, I'm like, oh, I'm glad you called. I'm happy to help you make this educated decision on if PSLF makes sense for you or not. Because their colleagues, it probably totally could have made sense to refinance. But I think it's also interesting to hear that there is just a lack of trust in it in general. And when you're dealing with lots of student loan debt, six figures of student loan debt, it can feel like a gamble if you don't know the inner workings of the program and you don't have faith in it. So I totally understand that now.
When you're talking about the headline problem, right? I'm just going to get vulnerable and share a problem that I'm dealing with that maybe a lot of people are dealing with in their personal life. So I helped a family member get access to the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. And now I'm this terrible person because they saw this headline that Johnson & Johnson is going to clot all of your blood and kill you. Like, I'm joking around about this a little bit because it's six people out of 7 million or something had a very serious blood clot thing, but probably thousands of people, if not tens of thousands of lives, have probably already been saved because of that same vaccine. So it's sort of like that, like, you have this headline problem and then it freaks people out where they look at all these things that they don't really understand. And because they don't understand it, but they see the headline and people get scared. And then there's the second article headline. Like, I saw, I think New York Times or Washington Post, it was like, what to talk to your doctor about if you're, like, having a severe blood clot from, like, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. So, like, we should be writing articles too about, you know, how to talk to your doctor about what happens when a meteor hits your foot. You know what I mean? Like, if you follow the PSLF rules, like, it's going to work out. It is. Mm-hmm. It's too important of a program. It's too built into the fabric of the promissory notes to not work out, like, exactly as it's supposed to work out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Megan, like, what do we get a lot of? People reaching out with FFEL loans that have paid for 10 years on an extended or graduated plan, and they reach out, and what do they say about the PSLF program because they don't qualify?
That it's horrible because they can't have access to it right now. They could start from now, but if we weren't following the rules from the beginning of that program, then we have to start from at this point. And those with FFEL loans, that's not a fix that we can go back and look at retroactively. At least if you were on the wrong repayment plan, that's something we could look at temporary expanded PSLF with. Yeah, people are angry about it. They're upset about it. And that skews their judgment of the program itself.
Well, yeah, like, exactly, pretty much. Like, it's not broken. Yeah, Congress screwed it up. Like, they did something really dumb when they wrote it that way. But based on the rules, FFEL loans don't qualify, and you were on a plan that doesn't count for PSLF. I'm sorry. I don't want to sound unempathetic. I do have empathy for these people because we see the strain that they have from finding out that they were given bad advice and they could have gotten on this qualifying plan years ago. And that sucks. And that's wrong. And that should be fixed, right? Let me say that. But let me also say that it's outside of the way the program is written. I mean, I see this, we see this all the time, right? Like, the other day, there was another one of these type of articles. This was from a group that wanted, like, mass cancellation for student loans, which, great. Like, that's a very valid approach to discuss. But they would intentionally cherry-picked everything to make it support their case, where it was like only 30 people have gotten, like, non-PSLF 25-year forgiveness over 25 years, right? Like, can you talk about, like, why we got upset about that headline?
Oh, yeah. I got super upset when I read it. I had so many of my friends, because they all know I'm a student loan nerd, send that to me, and they're like, uh-oh. And I'm like, no, it's not what it sounds like. But essentially, that article, it did cherry pick information. And it is accurate to the extent that there's very few people who could have been eligible for taxable loan forgiveness right now. And those few people would have had to have loans from the 90s. They would have had to have been perfect on their income-driven plan, income contingent repayment, which is a plan that we barely even talk about because it's the oldest plan in the books, very expensive plan. Yes, folks could be getting forgiveness right now. It's very not unlikely. That's not the term, but it's few and far between because few and far between people would have even been eligible to get the forgiveness right now. And so the article was making it sound like income-driven plans or the taxable forgiveness was broken. That wasn't even working. And on top of that, PSLF is a mess. So it just scared people into thinking, and I did get emails from people who said, does this mean that the plan we talked about for like pay or IBR, does this mean I need to switch gears? And I'm like, no, not at all. This is very skewed information that is, just as you said, it's meant to hone in on or support one thing that they're trying to go after, but they're using all the relevant data, not including anything that combats that or explains why it's like that, to support their case. And unfortunately, that does scare people. And that's similar with the PSLF article that came out, the 99% number. They didn't explain, or actually there was one article that talked about how a lot of that rejection rate number was because people applied for the program prematurely. And I think a common misconception with PSLF is that it's a 10-year program.
Right.
It is, but more technically, it's 120 qualifying payments. And so people applied and got denied because they had maybe 100 payments or 80 or something because they applied prematurely. Doesn't mean that they're not on track for the program, because that's what that article made it sound like. Oh, PSLF is broken. No, people just weren't quite there yet with their payment count, or, you know, they didn't submit the employment certification form, for example. So,
yeah, a fair headline would be PSLF communication is broken. Like,
yeah,
PSLF is a poorly designed program. Here's the proof.
Mm-hmm.
People don't understand PSLF at all. Those are like very fair headlines, right? Mm-hmm. But to say it's broken is like saying 3 million people have tried to go to space. Only 50 have succeeded. And it's like, well, you know, yeah, like if you don't sit in a rocket ship with like X amount of newtons of force or whatever, like you're not going to space. I mean, like that's not a perfect example, right? But it's like, you have to know that like you have to do these hard things. Like it just, so like the 25 year thing was like you had to pay 20% of your income for 25 years on loans that were like very limited of what you could take out. So it is almost like you had to intentionally like not pay for as long as possible and get a graduate degree, make $15,000 a year for 25 years with the aptitude of knowing how to like consolidate and get all everything set up exactly the right way when it wasn't really designed that way. Yeah. And like ICR, which was the only plan available until IBR in 2009, ICR takes a PhD to figure out. Mm-hmm. Like if you really get into it, the payment is 20% of your income minus 100% of the poverty line, or it's the minimum of that number, or the 12-year amortization of the loan, which sounds easy, but times an income-sensitive percentage factor, okay? And so this income-sensitive percentage factor ranges from like 0.5 to 2, and so you take the 12-year amortization number and you multiply it by a very complicated number between 0.5 to 2. And that's how you figure out the pay. So like, if I can barely figure this out, and I used to be a bond trader, is like Sallie Mae and AES and like all these like servicers that existed like before computing was like very easily done, widespread, I guess, in the 90s, right? What's the chances that they would have even like spent resources to figure that out and like offer that to people, right? So like they probably didn't even offer it to people either.
No, that article, like I would have done the complete reverse of that whole thought process. Like the title on that one for income contingent repayment or the 30 people who only 30 people have gotten taxable forgiveness. I would have done something. I would have said something like, holy cow, we've had 30 people get
taxable forgiveness. It's not zero. Amazing. Oh, like my who are these people and what kind of secret? I don't know.
They're the smart astronauts that got in the rocket and went to the moon.
Yeah. Like, why haven't you invented Tesla instead of figure out how to get student loan forgiveness? Like, what? Like,
yeah.
I mean, we'd spent a lot of time on that particular point, but I think it's a really important one, which is why I think we decided to talk so much about it. Because it's basically like forgiveness alone, like a special forgiveness program isn't the answer. Like, that's not going to eliminate all your negative feelings about student loans. Like, only a very clear plan can reduce it. And that doesn't mean that you have to get that necessarily from us, but you do need a plan because it's going to reduce those negative thoughts, mm-hmm. which lead to negative emotions. So forgiveness programs aren't the answer. You need a plan. You need to figure out a way where you can get help for your student loans and get a clear plan. Even if that's not with us, it's fine. Get a plan from something or somewhere. That way you don't have to have this debt stress you out as much.
Yeah, get the validation even. I think validation also provides a lot of peace of mind to know that you think you figured it out. Let me go double check. Even if it's like confirming with the servicer or scheduling a consult with us, like just triple check, you know, make sure that you, and that could be a way that brings some peace of mind around it, I think.
Yeah. So the last couple points about the findings for this mental health survey, obviously people that have lower incomes had a lot higher levels of ideation. So you might say that if you're going to do cancellation, which 85% of our audience thought that there should be cancellation, but only 32% thought it should be for all of the debt. So in other words, the vast majority of people of our audience want cancellation, but the majority didn't think that it should necessarily all be canceled for everyone, which was kind of interesting. But even six-figure income earners, 4% of people who had a debt-to-income ratio less than one had ideation, and 8% of people that had DTI over 2-to-1 did had ideation. So like that's kind of, so two times as high of suicidal ideation due to student loans, even for six-figure income earners, once you have a debt-to-income ratio over 2-to-1. So this idea of student loan debt as an income tax, like it makes mathematical sense, but we're still not translating it as well as we need to reach that audience. So let's talk about a couple groups that had lower ideation levels. A little bit of a positive here. Physicians, only 1%. That's kind of shocking. I guess they were too busy with managing the pandemic to worry about their student loans. Megan, what do you think's driving that?
Potentially. Or I think physicians also have, well, going back to PSLF in a sense, they do have access to PSLF and they have the resources to hire, you know, someone to help them figure it out and maximize it as much as possible. Could be arrogance too, or overconfident. And maybe...
Careful.
Oh, yeah. I don't like
No, it's fine. You're going to get in as much trouble as I did over my joke about Polish dentists charging $20 and a beer for a root canal. Well, no, but physicians do kind of tend to obviously be very smart people and yeah, know definitely. When to reach out like for help and when and how to a lot of times do very detailed research and analysis about the solution. Like whenever I get like a insane level of spreadsheets and... One person sent me this like documentation along with the ID badge number of every person at FedLoan she'd ever spoken with.
Whoa.
Yeah. So like usually those people are always physicians. I don't know why. I guess that's the kind of person I'd want operating on me,
that's
right?
True. Yeah. And why I was thinking about that is I typically will get a very analytical physician who does want to comb through like the very specific numbers and how things work exactly. But you're exactly right. That's who I want operating on me if something's wrong.
Well, yeah, it's so like 1% of physicians said they'd had suicidal ideation due to student loan debt. 3% of physicians said they'd had it from the pandemic. That was the only occupation, I think, that we had more people having ideation from the pandemic than from student loans. Thankfully, in both cases, the numbers were fairly low compared to the population at large. I guess also, like, if you think about who's your typical physician, 250K of student loan debt and 200K of income. That's like a very average, you know, physician setup. And that debt-to-income ratio is already better than 1.25 to 1. In other words, like that person already can pay back her debt if she wants to, or she can go for forgiveness. And so I think that there's not a lot of physicians out there besides physicians in like primary care, probably in the private sector where student loan debt probably like truly makes someone feel trapped, I guess. Like that's my interpretation of that.
It's a great point.
Whereas it's like pick any other occupation, you don't see people that have consistently that high of an income straight out of the gate.
Not at all.
And also the debts are lower in the medical school world than they are in the dental or veterinary world, right? So you've got higher incomes with lower debt, which is why I think that like medicine, even though it's extremely stressful for some non-financial reasons, tends to show up okay compared to some of these other professions with student loan debt stress. Married people had a lot lower stress due to student loans. I guess that's because they were so worried about what car they're going to buy, what house they're going to buy, what kind of parenting style they're going to... I'm joking, you know, as a married person, I feel like I can get away with saying that because my wife doesn't listen to the show, I hope. So I'm just kidding. I guess maybe it's a debt-to-income thing. What do you think the lower ideation levels, if you're married, coming from?
Yeah, debt-to-income, because there's dual income usually coming in the door. Support, generally, they'd have someone to support them emotionally, potentially financially. It's two people, not just one person you're talking about, really. When you're married, everything is everybody's business in that relationship.
Yeah. So let's say that having more than double your income in student debt's bad and you want to fix that. Let's do a lightning round where we just talk about some of the things that you could do to fix this. So if you wanted to share some of the thoughts that like we've debated on the team as to like how you would fix the student loan crisis if you wanted to.
Yeah. So one that I've always thought made sense was instituting some kind of cap on how much tuition could be or how much a school could charge.
Yeah. So another one, student loan cancellation, particularly for people that like are the lower income end of the scale, like facing the big economic hardships that especially the people who've been most affected by the pandemic. So that could be another.
Mm-hmm. Bankruptcy protections, allowing borrowers in worst financial situations a way out. I've written a couple articles now for Student Loan Planner on bankruptcy stuff, and it does amaze me that student loans are just an anomaly in the bankruptcy world in the sense that they have different rules, which that could be a solution, is lightening those rules or protections.
Yeah, at least letting people that are definitely not going to pay it back like have a little easier path towards bankruptcy. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So another thing is changing or capping borrowing limits. So this is similar to instituting caps on tuition. But just saying that, you know, you can, we already say this with Stafford loans. We say you can only take out X amount of Stafford loans, but then we have this other thing called Grad Plus where you can take out as much as you want.
Yeah.
And so maybe it might make sense to say, well, we'll have Grad Plus, but we're only going to make it accessible to whatever, first generation students from underrepresented backgrounds, right? Like basically like force the people who can get underwritten loans to go get underwritten loans so that we have some downward pressure on tuition while not destroying the access gains that have been made across a lot of different fields of people that historically haven't had access to this level of degrees financially before, right?
Mm-hmm. Another would be maybe civil penalties for institutions that intentionally misstate student outcomes for purposes of maybe improving enrollment. The borrower's defense program is something that could be maybe used for folks in that situation where they feel like they were defrauded or lied to or misled in their enrollment process to a school, or the school closed down in the midst of their education journey. There is a program that is also in the news a lot right now for, it was being delayed. Applications were being delayed. Now they're starting to get pushed through. I think you had talked about that on one of your weekly e-blasts recently, but it is something that exists. But yeah, I think there should be harsher penalties for something like that.
I mean, we hear it all the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sorry for interrupting, but like, how often do we hear like the chiropractors being like, yeah, their school told us we were going to make like over 100,000 and we're making 50.
Yeah.
Or the dental schools that are like, oh, our average repayment period is 7 years when you would have to pay more than 100% of your income to be able to make that true.
Mm.
So there's all these like things that they just say.
Yeah.
That are not based in reality, that are like really dangerous, right?
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's no accountability for these schools. They still get the money, and that's what their goal is, to fill the seats and do so however they can.
Mm-hmm.
So a few more here. I came up with this one. A Surgeon General's warning affixed to the promissory note that says something like government warning, borrowing more than, that's terrible, right? Borrowing more than your income is hazardous to your health.
Mm-hmm.
Do so at your own risk. I mean, something just to like wake people up and say, hey,
yeah,
this is serious. The schools just get off by being like, oh, it's good debt. Oh, here you go. Just sign. Oh, we need your financial aid form. Can you fill it out, please? They can make it sound so nice. And it's like, wait a second, you're harming people's lives sometimes.
Yeah.
And yet there's no accountability. So I was thinking that would be one.
This is maybe a funny spin on that. Reading the terms and conditions of things. There was a woman here in Georgia, some article was written about it maybe about a year or two ago, but a woman was always methodical about reading the terms and conditions of anything she signed. And in a travel insurance package that she was signing, there was one line in that terms and conditions that said, if you've gotten to this point, you've read this far, email us, you've won $10,000. And she literally got a check for $10,000 for reading the terms and conditions. It was really cool. I thought it was awesome.
Yeah, I'm going to just control F now from now on. If you have made it to, you know, yeah. So three more here. Reducing or eliminating financial aid access for schools that have bad debt to income ratios. That would fix the problem in a hurry, right?
Mm-hmm. They do that for default rates, but yeah, they don't do it for higher debt to income ratios. That could be a solution.
High debt to income ratios is a failure.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, right? Like if you're producing people that have high debt to income ratios, like your degree is economically not worth it, like to society the way you've structured it.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is it could still be worth it to the borrower, right? It could still be a fantastic because the borrower can pay 10% of their income.
Yeah.
But if we're spending 600 grand on like dental school for someone, that's taking money out of the pot that we could have used for early childhood education or electric vehicles or fixing Social Security or tax reform or whatever your thing is, right? Like that's a degree that's financially, economically broken and should be fixed. So a couple other ones, lowering the interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
So what might the schools do if they lowered interest rates from 6 or 8, 7% to 3%? What do you think the schools would do?
Yeah, they would increase the tuition to compensate.
Yeah.
It doesn't solve it.
Yeah. It would help it if you paired like 3% on interest rates plus limiting tuition or like capping what schools could charge. And same thing with like cancellation or turning loans into grants. It would help as long as you like paired it with something, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you would have to like, it would be hard because there's interest groups in that affect both parties, right? So like the for-profit school industry is like got the Republican Party on speed dial. I'm sorry, it's true. And then like the higher education, like nonprofit industry has the Democratic Party on speed dial. I guess that's kind of at least my impression from how you see different groups talk about these different interest groups. And I would say certainly the for-profit industry is like probably a worse offender on average. I don't even think the for-profit industry should have access to federal financial aid.
Mm.
But I guess like everybody protects the nonprofit industry of educational institutions when like these are like profit hungry. A lot of these groups are just like tearing people's lives to shreds and there's just no, they don't care at all. Like policymakers, it seems like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just lack of accountability anywhere. Like there's no responsibility when it comes to the aftermath of where we're at. And there's so many fingers to point. It can go a lot of different directions, but it's unfortunate overall.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to fix the student loan crisis.
Right.
I'm going to admit that I am not a policymaker, and thank goodness I'm not. Let's talk about ways that an individual can concretely help himself or herself with getting help with mental health if they feel like they need it. So a couple resources. If you want to first, I guess, mention again the hotline to call if someone's having any suicidal thoughts or has or knows someone who is, what should people do?
Yeah, so the hotline to call would be 1-800-273-TALK, T-A-L-K. That's a national suicide prevention hotline. There are folks waiting by the phone to answer within a ring or two. So that's one resource you can reach out to.
Yeah, and if you're having suicidal thoughts, make use of that. Like, that's what it's for. Don't be like, oh, like I want to save the space for people who are not having as bad as me.
You're important.
Go ahead and use the call. Yeah, you're an important person and you need to make that phone call if you're facing those thoughts for any reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think you listed some really good counseling services as well. BetterHelp and Talkspace. I've seen both of those a lot lately. They've been doing some really good marketing, which is great. Those are really easy, accessible services to be able to get help. And I think that's virtual, right? That's on the phone or maybe a Skype call.
But yeah, the hardest part of therapy is like getting in the car and driving like the 25 minutes to the therapist office, right? And then driving back. Instead, you can literally just have like a video conference with somebody, and it's probably not covered by insurance, I'm going to guess, but you could probably spend your HSA money on it. I think I pay less than $300 a month for professional weekly counseling, where I just get to talk for an hour. And like the student loan planner team can tell people that I love talking. So like, that's so great that I get to pay somebody that has to listen to me for an hour a week, that I get to just talk about my frustrations and fears and anxieties and depressive feelings if I have them, or share victories for like things that are going well that week. So I guess like behind me, written on my, like my board, I've got these five things. One of them is gratitude. Grow gratitude by writing down three things that you're thankful for. Journal one positive experience every day. Exercise for 20 minutes every day. Pray 5 minutes every day. And do a random act of kindness. So those are my five things to try to like improve happiness. So like, that's the kind of stuff that you'll get out of counseling. If you're anxious, you should not call the National Suicide Hotline. That's not what it's for. If you are anxious or having depressive feelings where it's not like full-blown depression or something, I think that's when a lot of these like virtual services could really be really helpful. And obviously, if you're having anxiety or hopelessness around your student debt, that's where we can fix it. Like, we're going to fix that better than any counseling service, because we know all the tools necessary to deliver the plan that's going to help you realize that the debt doesn't need to define your life. And you know, a counselor is going to be able to treat the symptoms of your feelings, but they're not going to be able to address like root cause. How do we fix this problem? That's really what we can do if you're having negative feelings about your student debt. So I'll just mention a couple other resources here. So there's occupation specific groups. Veterinarians have this group called Not One More Vet, which is a Facebook group, which is great. That's, you know, because there's a lot of, unfortunately, suicide that happens in the veterinary community, and they built an occupation support group to try to help fix that problem. Conferences, professional meetings, friends, family, hanging out with people. Obviously, all that's taken a hit with the pandemic, right, Megan?
Yeah.
I think that's one of the reasons why mental health is worse this year. I can certainly say that's the case for me. I don't know about you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not being around other people, or not being around other like-minded people too, except for just virtually, maybe. It's been tough. Humans are meant to be around other humans, and this pandemic has been really hard on a lot of folks. Even I would consider myself kind of a recluse in a sense, and even me, like it's taxing on someone. And you know, so some of these options could be really great to just be able to dissect those feelings, dissect how you can make things better for yourself, how you can take actionable steps to progress and to just improve.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm like as extroverted as extroverts get. And that's why this pandemic has been a disaster for me, because my wife's a healthcare professional. And so like she's wanted obviously to make sure we're extra cautious beyond just like the normal CDC guidelines. So I've tried to adhere to that. And oh my gosh, it's been hard. I saw something on social media that was like, thoughts and prayers for the extroverts in your life. Like, you know, I mean, it's been a hard year for us very E individuals. Whatever is going on in your life, you're worth it. You're worth it. Spend the money, get the help you need, be it the counseling, be it the more serious like support if you need it, the student loan help if you need that. Like whatever you're going through, just know that it's going to get better, I think. I can't promise that, but I think that it is going to get better. This pandemic will start to fade as more and more people get vaccinated. And then we'll have something else to worry about, right? Heaven forbid North Korea like starts testing nukes again or something. I don't know.
Oh,
there will be somebody will get, some celebrity will get a divorce and none of us saw it coming. I'm trying to joke around a little bit here, but but there will always be things to worry about, both on a societal level and an individual level. And the societal stuff you can't control, but the individual stuff with a lot of work and support and seeking out resources, you can have some significant control over it. So don't feel powerless. Reach out to folks that can help you. We can help you if it's about student debt. Megan, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Yeah, thank you. This was a tougher one, I will say, but I hope it helps some folks and helps people not feel so alone with some of these things. Hopefully our horrible jokes lightened it up a little bit and my horrible rumbling through this.
Maybe. Remember, folks, you're worth it. Thanks so much. And thank you for listening to the Student Loan Planner Podcast.